I'm not sure the Department of Education provides any useful service at this point. My parents were both school administrators, and they spent their entire summers just filling out paperwork to comply with Department of Education requirements, which seems silly. You know, the majority of funding comes from states, from local property taxes. So little of it actually comes to the Department of Education. You can still do all the things the department does that are good, FAFSA, among other things, by moving them into other departments, the Department of Treasury. You can do civil rights stuff in the Department of Justice, the Justice Department. That would be fine. It's just kind of acting as a middleman. You could just go block grants for education straight to the states. That would be fine. So I'm not devastated by the loss of the Department of Education. However, I do not think a president has the power to eradicate a department created by Congress. All executive departments are created by Congress. So if Congress will pass a law eradicating the Department of Education, which is something we've done before, then I'm not going to weep about it.
Let's go!
Well, welcome back, everybody, to another episode of I Came of Fire podcast. We have, for the third time, Dr. Savannah Eccles Johnston. Thank you so much for coming back. We talked about doing this when you were on last time. We had made vague mention of doing maybe 100 days of Trump, and now we have a lot to talk about. It's not just 100 days. There's so much going on. And I sort of, well, before I let you introduce yourself for all of our new listeners, I just wanted to say, too, that aside from the AirPod theme, right, there has also been a theme in our conversations about executive power. And I thought that that may be a good place to start this conversation. So, yeah, let's go ahead. If you wouldn't mind introducing yourself just for the new listeners, and we can jump right in.
My name is Savannah Eccles Johnston. I'm a professor of political science. I specialize in American political thought and constitutionalism. And that's it. That's all there is to know about me.
Awesome. Yeah. No, those are some good things, I think. You actually have your own podcast, too. I just want to throw that out there for everybody. This Constitution is actually really good. You guys, I feel like, offer very good, non-slanted conversation that's just facts-based about a lot of different things. I learned a lot, actually, about executive power specifically from listening to you and the other professors, I assume, that are there at your school. So check that out, too, guys, if you guys are into other podcasts. So, but yes, other times we've spoken, we've talked about consolidation of executive power, right? And I think the last time we talked, you made mention sort of in one of the Federalist Papers about the Republican executive and how much that's changed. You talked a lot about FDR and what that looked like. And now even to parallel FDR, Trump has even floated the idea of a third term. And so I wanted to just open the floor to you. Your first impression of his 100 days.
My first impression is people are viewing the Trump administration in terms of Democrat and Republican. And yes, of course, that's true. But I think it is far more significant in its implications for the Republican executive, for the rise of the executive, for almost an imperial presidency. I don't think we've seen an executive since FDR that has so challenged the checks and balances system, primarily because not only is he trying to challenge and push the boundaries, which presidents do, that's something they naturally do, but because Congress has nearly completely abdicated any kind of pushback. And we're seeing the weakness of the courts. This is actually something that's so interesting. Alexander Hamilton told us back in the Federalist Papers, don't worry about the courts. You'll never have to worry about those guys. They have neither force nor will. They just have pens. Don't worry about them. And for the longest time, I'd be like, oh, Hamilton, you are so wrong. But actually,
right,
in the end, unless the American people back the Supreme Court or Congress backs the Supreme Court, they actually don't have any enforcement mechanism at all. So
it's true.
That's a very interesting thing. So I'm viewing the first 100 days in this checks and balances system. It's something I've been concerned about for a really long time. I'm very wary of executive power, and I think we're seeing an expansion of it.
Yeah, no doubt. I actually really like that you mentioned the Supreme Court. I was having a conversation with somebody the other day about it, and they were, well, it was really about this 9-0 ruling when it comes to Abrego, the guy from Maryland. And they were coming at it from a very ideologically driven way, right? And I was just explaining, I said, you know, it's okay to think that way. I was like, but the Supreme Court is probably one of the most malleable functions of our government that we have. They get to decide what cases they take. They are not permanent. They all have their own, everybody has their own personal ideologies. And so you are so beholden to whoever is there. And it almost sometimes doesn't even matter what political side of the aisle they're on. So it is probably one of the most flexible parts of our government. And so it's interesting that you said that, because this ruling has caused all of this stir now here, people calling it a constitutional crisis. We could have a conversation about that if you'd like. I disagree, but that's just my opinion. And I think too that the rule of law, while it is the rule of law, you cannot replace or you cannot mistake ideological viewpoints of it with practicality. And to maybe tie it into FDR, there was a war going on. There's an emergency. I view the situation of 30 million illegal immigrants in this country as a national emergency. So I feel like boxing ourselves in or painting ourselves into the corner of trying to remain this ideologically sound institution sort of, it does. It paints us into a corner on the practicality front. And if TJ or Chris has, and go ahead, Doctor.
This is a really interesting point. You say this is a crisis. This is ultimately about immigration and illegal immigration and protecting the sovereignty of the nation. It is not a question that a nation has the right to protect its borders. Every mm-hmm. sovereign nation on earth has the right to protect its borders. That's what makes you a sovereign nation. And right. So as a result, a nation has every right to deport someone who is in the country illegally. Just full stop, period. Right. The question at hand here isn't, can you deport someone who's here illegally? It's not, do countries have the right to patrol their borders? Those are matters of right. policy. Those are beyond question. The core of this is, do you have due process rights? Mm-hmm. And the answer constitutionally is, every single person in this country, non-citizen and citizen, here legally or illegally, has the right to due process. Meaning, if you're going to arrest someone at a traffic stop and accuse them of being in this country illegally, or much worse, a terrorist as a result of a connection to MS-13, which has recently been designated a terrorist organization, correct. You have to prove it. The onus is always on government to prove before they can do anything to remove life, liberty, or property from you per the 14th and 5th Amendments. This process correct. Really matters. Now, once they've proven you're here illegally, we don't see any papers, then, do what you want to do. Deport him. Just not to El Salvador, because a judge in 2019 said you can't do that. You can't deport him there. But deport him anywhere else. Fine. But the question is due process. You have to give people a hearing.
Mm-hmm. So we were having a conversation last night with a lady. Her name is Katarina Schultz. She's a reporter. You may have seen her. I've shared some of her stuff before, but she's a reporter in Mexico. She talks a lot about the cartels. Mm. And we were having a conversation about this, and I essentially made the point that you just can't have, I just don't see how it's practical to have due process trials, right, for 30 million people. Obviously, we're not all at once, indicting and charging and going through process of 30 million people all at once. And I think that there's going to be mistakes. I think it's just, this is one of these things where if evidence says that he is indeed an MS-13 member, right, then that should be presented. Absolutely. We talked about this last night, and that no evidence should be disregarded, whether it's to free somebody or indict them of a crime, right? I just find this to be, it's a massive gray area to me when it comes to this many people and deporting them. I don't know. Chris and TJ, do you guys have input?
No, I mean, nothing other than what kind of the point that I was making previously on this, and that, it's like, hey, let the punishment fit the crime. That's always important. And also, you guys have already beat the dead horse of due process. But, looking at it from a military man's standpoint, and, we've made the statement that this, like, is indeed an invasion that we've been experiencing, that's led to this migrant crisis. I'm more prepared than most when it comes to understanding that there are going to be casualties, right? Like there's always casualties in war and things happen. But then I also have to try and check myself, because it's like when you start using militant language like that and you say things like war, right? It goes, my brain's been churning while I'm listening to you guys talk about the expansion of like presidential powers and everything. And like one of the themes that I consistently see is that use of like militant language and national emergencies and wartime circumstances in order to overreach those powers and expand them. Like my favorite example is when Abraham Lincoln imprisoned a large portion, I think it was of the Baltimore City Council, if I remember correctly. Doctor, check my knowledge on that one. And then held them without due process, suspended habeas corpus on them, because they were fomenting not the Republic, but the rebels' cause, right? And then that would have brought the Civil War much too close.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, to the White House. And so it's like, I don't want to see the, yes, deport them all. However, it's like we have the ability to be precise in what we do. And if we don't hold ourselves to the Constitution, if we don't hold ourselves to our guiding principles, then basically all you're saying is it's okay when we do it. And then that's an ever expanding problem. And I've been pretty adamant on how it's okay when we do it can never be the standard, because then it only matters who's in the White House, who's in government. But those were just some of the thoughts that went through my head. It wasn't really a question.
Totally coming back to that later.
I'm sorry, but that's just some of the stuff that you brought up while I was listening to the back and forth. And forgive me, I'm sick tonight. So
I think that was well said. Can I clarify one thing about Lincoln and habeas corpus? I think this is important. Lincoln didn't violate the Constitution here. So he suspends habeas corpus. He calls up the troops. He, you know, blockades southern ports. Right. Congress isn't in session. Suspending habeas corpus is clearly a congressional power. It's found in Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution, not Article 2. So as soon as they come back into session, he asks them to ratify everything he's done. Basically, now I need you to do it, because I was acting in an emergency situation when you weren't here to do it. And eventually these people did get a trial, is the point. So I just want to make sure Lincoln didn't violate the Constitution.
No, that's an excellent point. The devil's in the details, and we strive to be accurate. So thank you very much. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I would just ask you this question then. Do you feel like it is this idea of practicality and ideology and remaining true to principle, like you said, Chris, when it comes to the executive, do you feel like that is practical even now in this situation, emergency powers being all that, declaring emergency with illegal immigration? Or do you think that is more of a relative conversation? Does that make sense?
Her.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were asking him. Okay.
Forgive me.
Sorry. Repeat for me. Practicality versus.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people tend to view our principles here in the United States as absolute. Okay. And I think that history would show you that while we lip service that all the time, that it is an absolute thing, these are just American ideals, that the behavior and the language we use are two absolutely different things, and that history would show it is rules for thee and not for me, and that these ideals and principles we're supposed to be upholding tend to be relative to whoever is in office, and that, you know, again, it is in the 2020 of hindsight is forgiven, sort of, right? And so does that make this consolidation of executive power here in the moment okay, as I think Trump would think it's okay, be given some of his language and then the whatever, I can't remember the exact language of the quote he shared from Napoleon about no man can do no wrong who saves his country, because that's how he's viewing this, right? And so I'm asking this question to you, if you think that that's a valid statement.
No, I don't. No, it's interesting what you say, that history shows it's, you know, rules for me or not for thee, or rules for thee and not for me. That's not how constitutions work. That's not how constitutional government works. That's how dictatorship works. I absolutely insist that institutional rules apply in every single case. I mean, look at Nixon, right? Nixon wildly violates the oath of office, which in his mind would have been justified because of the policies he's trying to enact, et cetera, et cetera. Doesn't matter. It's the Republicans in the Senate who turn against him. It's Barry Goldwater who goes and says, Mr. President, we will impeach you for this because the rules, the standards matter. If you cannot hold that the presidency in check, even when it's your guy, you will lose constitutional government. The rules, the processes, they always have to matter. We have to be absolutely adamant that the process matters. And sometimes that means you don't get what you want, and we got to get over that. And actually, let's talk about Lincoln for just one more second. Is that okay? Because he he personifies this. It's one of the reasons I just adore Lincoln. So Lincoln is an ardent opponent of the expansion of slavery into the territories. But he makes it very clear that Congress and the president have no authority to abolish slavery where it already exists in the South. As much as he would like to, as much as his personal feeling is to abolish slavery in the South, he has no pathway to do so outside of constitutional amendment, which in 1861 is impossible. And so he is willing to take the long-term approach, which is moral, as someone, Diana Schaub is a great scholar of Lincoln, and she calls this moral and physical quarantine of slavery. You morally quarantine it as an evil thing, which is tolerated in the South, and you physically quarantine it in the South, and eventually it will be eradicated, but long-term thinking. So he's not willing to give up processes to his own personal political wishes, and I think that sets up a remarkable standard for American politics.
And yet wasn't, I'm going to say something at the risk of possibly sounding really dumb in front of you, ma'am. And yet wasn't the Emancipation Proclamation an executive order?
It was, and it was only legally binding for, so let's look at what the Emancipation Proclamation actually does. So what it actually does is only free enslaved persons in unconquered rebelling territories. And it does so under the commander-in-chief power that this is the only way to weaken the Southern economy, basically strip them of their free labor, bring 200,000 new soldiers into the Union Army, and we could win the war. And he actually had really serious questions. He wasn't sure if the Emancipation Proclamation would be legally valid if the war ended. And of course, the Emancipation Proclamation did not apply to conquered territories in Louisiana, parts of Virginia, nor did it apply in the border states where the Union was in control. So it was actually quite limited, and that's why he pushes for the 13th Amendment. So yes, it was via executive order, but it was executive order tied to a military purpose, and for that reason alone, it was legally justified.
So I just want to make it clear, you know, I agree with everything you're saying, asking questions like this, almost from a devil's advocate standpoint. Because I do find it really interesting. I agree with you, you know, that we should stand on principle and we have to stand on principle. I also, in some aspects, though, do see where it paints us into corners. Mostly in like the geopolitical sphere, I can see where it mostly paints us into corners because we're beholden, I think, to a higher standard we say we are than some other countries, right? So that's where the waters get murky. And maybe we can have a conversation about that, too. But I'm going to really crappily probably quote Voltaire here, and because I think the problems that we have with why Congress is so weak is really just downstream of a lot of problems that the American people have overall. And Voltaire was talking about the British here, and he was talking about religion in Britain. So I'm going to substitute the word religion for politics. And he says in Britain, if there was one political party, we would have despotism. If there were two, then we would be cutting each other's throats. And because there are 30, we have peace and harmony, right? And here now in America, we see two, and we are at each other's throats completely and totally. And I think that causes gridlock, and that's exactly why we have such a weak Congress, and that we don't have the ideological marketplace anymore. And that is exactly why we don't have movement. Go ahead.
I'm not sure. No one likes the two-party system, but I'm not actually sure that's 100% accurate. We've had a two-party system our entire existence, and we've had peace. We've had eras of great inter-party cooperation. We've had eras of remarkable congressional control. We've had eras where Congress actually turned against a president of their own party. So it doesn't seem to be the two-party system necessarily that's the problem. It seems to be the balance between institutional thinking in Congress and partisan loyalty. That's the problem.
I think that, let me rephrase that, because I don't think the two-party system is a problem. I think that the two lanes that people are stuck in is the problem, and that people and politicians downstream of the people, they want to see just the partisan politics. People do. And that's kind of what I meant. Not that the two-party system, sorry to have to clarify that. But that because of just how ideologically trapped most people are in either left or right, that these representatives are doing that on purpose to essentially keep them happy. And that's the gridlock. Does that make more sense?
Yes. Yeah. And in which case we're agreeing that partisan loyalty has become a problem. It's become deeply tribal. Yeah.
Yeah. I just don't. Go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to say, and I also think to a certain extent, there's also becoming like a class loyalty over loyalty to country too, wherein I describe it just kind of using common speak, that whatever keeps the rich and powerful, it's the rich and powerful versus like the common man. Because you'll see it all the time where videos will pop up of Mitch McConnell high-fiving Nancy Pelosi on the floor of Congress, because these people all know each other, and I think a lot of what goes on, and correct me if I'm wrong, is a lot of political theater for the upkeep of this veneer of bipartisan politics, that it's like Republicans versus Democrats, because it really keeps the American people politically divided and put into camps, when largely I think it largely comes down to, the government versus the people, because of the way that it's expanded. But I feel free to check me on that. Absolutely.
Oh, I'm not sure I would put it quite in those stark terms. I could see where you're coming from, that you feel like it's really, people in power versus the, and there is some of that. You see like the refusal to ban insider trading in Congress, right? Gross. Mm-hmm. No one likes that. But also I think the vitriol in Congress, the vitriol between members of Congress, that's not fake. That is real. And it's a real problem actually to getting any work done. But I see what you mean about there. I can understand a legitimate concern that there is some kind of ruling elite that looks down on, controls, and mocks everyone else. And I think that's a very real feeling, and there's something to it.
Well, let me ask you this, because I do agree with you, Chris. I think that there is, and we've talked about this. We talked about this a lot with Batya Unger-Sargon when she came on, about sort of the new populist right, and how much that populism normally exists with the liberal left in the country, and it's sort of shifted. But do you think this messaging that Donald Trump is doing right now about being the president for the people? Scott Bessent made the comment about how this isn't about Wall Street anymore, this is about Main Street. Do you agree with that? Do you think that the actions being taken now represent, or the actions and the words align, do you think? Dr. Johnston?
Oh, you're talking to me again. I'm sorry.
I am. Yeah. No, you're. Chris. Yes. I'm not at sorry. All. Sorry. You are. Yes.
I was interested to see what Chris was going to say to that. No, I don't. I don't think that. I think there's a number of examples where Donald Trump's policies are going to significantly harm the average American. For example, his tariffs will significantly harm the average American. I think the rule of law benefits the average man far more than a kind of kleptocracy does. The ruling elite, the wealthy, will always get by, but the rule of law protects the average person more than anything else. Their greatest safety is in the rule of law. I believe in free trade. I can't help it. I'm a free trader. What can I say? I think mass deportation of 30 million people would cripple the U.S. economy. So, no, I don't think his policies are going to help Main Street. But that's a policy disagreement that I have with President Trump. I have constitutional disagreements, but these are just policy disagreements. And I think policy disagreements that come because I'm very pro-immigration and I'm very pro-free trade and and all of this. So,
mm-hmm. Well, since you were interested in my answer, I would say yes. And we can argue about the policies, or maybe debate is a better word, the policies and what the outcomes of those policies are going to be. But from my viewpoint, it would seem that his actions are at least in alignment with what he believes would be best for the common man in America. And I think, like, when he's doing things like, you know, having his Justice Department refer, you know, corrupt AGs for prosecution, you know, cleaning up the law system, I think that he truly believes that the tariffs are going to help the middle class of America in the long run. Like, I've long held the opinion and stated out loud, yes, it's gonna hurt in the short term, and you're gonna see the prices go up. But I think when you start talking about the long term health of the American economy, I think that it would be a good thing, and I think that he truly believes that it's going to be a good thing. Like, why else would he be doing it if he was just another politician that was interested in securing his book deals and his speaking tours when he gets out of office? Like, why would he be interested in shaking up the system so much, because everything he does is so controversial? And I think that he also believes that mass deportations are going to be good for the American people and the American economy as well, because I think that Donald Trump recognizes that a country is not, you know, made up of just individual economic units that can be shifted across borders. You can't just import one culture into the middle of another culture and then, like, nothing happens. People are a shared group of beliefs and norms, and, you know, like, that's what we are. And so it's like, you can't just commingle these things and not expect volatility to happen. And I think that Donald Trump being, you know, a good boy from downtown New York, like, I think that he's in love with the 1980s Americana. You know, there he made the bulk of his money in the heyday, and I think he wants to see the restoration of American culture, and that's largely where those decisions are coming from too. So for all those reasons, like, I would say that his actions are in keeping with that, and it would seem that he does at least believe what he's saying, and he's acting on those beliefs. Now, whether or not those policies are going to be good in the long run, as we all argue about, it remains to be seen. We're all in this thing together.
If I can respond to that for just a second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, please.
This idea of, does he actually believe his policies? I think on tariffs, he certainly does. I think he actually does believe that tariffs are going to lead to the outcomes. I think he's wrong, but I think he actually believes that. So I think you're right in saying that. And I also think there are things Donald Trump has done that I can't help but cheer over, mostly things about gender ideology. Right. These are happy outcomes. But you mentioned something. You said we can't just import an entirely new culture into the current culture. And that's interesting, because that's actually the American story. That's what we've done over and over and over in four different waves of immigration. We just keep doing it. And every single time we have the same reaction. These people are too different from us. They're incapable of being Americans. And yet every time, within two generations, they have so blended and so become part of our story that to imagine America without them is almost impossible. Now, there's a question of, how do you do assimilation correctly? How do you admit people correctly?
Me too.
How do you control the border? Of course, you have to control your border. Of course.
Right.
How do they get here? Of course. All these are all valid questions. But the idea that America has never imported an entirely new culture, absolutely we have. And we are uniquely positioned in the history of the world for being successful at doing that. And it's because we have a very different idea of American identity. At no point, I think, have we really truly believed that to be American is to be a descendant of the Puritan Anglo-Saxon tradition. Like, that's not what it is. So then what is an American? You know what a Japanese person is, right? They're ethnically Japanese. They speak Japanese. They eat Japanese food. It's a remarkably ethnically homogenous country. You know what that is. But who or what is an American? And I can't help but think that the only thing that binds this country together, because it is such a unique nation in the history of the world, is a common political ideal. It is attachment to the Declaration and the Constitution, to the Union, to the very idea of Union itself, and a Union created for a certain purpose. And this was, you know, James Madison's idea. Anyone who loves liberty, come here. This is your new empire. So if we view American identity through that lens, then we can take in mass numbers. In fact, the largest migration in human history is to America. We can take in mass numbers so long as we handle civic education well, we control the process. But yes, we can bring these people in.
So if I could just respond to you, Dr. Johnson. So I agree with you wholeheartedly that the identity of an American is somebody who comes here, and that it is an extremely diverse background of people. But I think the thing that makes it different now is that there are second and third generation Americans now in a row in leadership positions in business, you know, tech businesses, whatever, all these people who have never, ever had to wonder where their next meal is coming from. And there's generations and generations of people that have lived that way. They grew up that way. They were born into it, and they've never had to do that. And I think that too, you can talk about history and you can say, yes, we've done this traditionally over and over and over again for a couple centuries now. But I don't think that the shared struggle that anybody, any culture has to have to create identity exists in the way that it did before. Even to talk about the Gilded Age, when there were so many immigrants coming into the United States, there was a shared struggle. The identity of America at the time was to build America, right? America is here for me to come to. It is the land of promise. It is the land of freedom. I can come here and have a business. There's this idea still of manifest destiny. I can move out west and I can go to Utah, or I can go to California or wherever, and I can find land and I can mine or whatever I'm going to do. I can start a business. And there's this idea of that. And I don't think that exists anymore. I think that, yes, there are enterprises in the United States that are new frontiers. AI might be one of those. Because AI will absolutely have the same or a larger effect of like something like the Gutenberg press, I think, for humanity. But I don't think that shared struggle exists anymore. And so you have to have that shared struggle to have assimilation. And because people come here knowing they don't have to struggle, they don't necessarily have to. I mean, they're going to struggle, but the idea is it's coming here, and there's already a safety net that exists for most people. I don't think you can have proper assimilation when you show up and don't have to contribute. You can sit and, not saying that people aren't contributing, but there are a lot of people who don't contribute, and you can't have an identity when you don't have shared struggle. Does that sort of make sense? What I'm getting? That's my position on that.
Wouldn't that make a good chunk of Americans un-American? They haven't had to struggle. I don't disagree with that either.
No, so, and I would argue the same thing. I would say that most Americans.
I would agree.
Yeah, most Americans have lost their identity of self because of not having to struggle for anything. Go ahead, DJ.
No worries. I guess where I split on that is strictly based upon our patriotism here, and that is the part that is missing, is people who originally came to the United States and they assimilated as a mass of cultures came here wanting to be Americans, believing in the American ideal. Right. The people that are coming here now, many of them have no interest whatsoever in actually becoming any part of this society permanently, or having their family fully integrated here, or living the American dream, or actually becoming true Americans. People who came here originally, they were flying the American flag before they were ever even citizens. They were coming over on boats with that pride instilled inside their hearts. Now people are coming here to be able to take advantage of systems. And quite often they're moving that money out of here. They're taking it back over where they came from. They're not interested in actually investing in this country for the interest of this country to be American people. They're interested in what they can get out of it and then getting back out of it. And that's a huge complication that we have. And I'm not talking about just illegal migrants by any means. It's a lot of these large business investors and everything from overseas that actually make up that population. Migrants, of course, they have a short-term goal. A lot of the guys that I speak to regularly from Costa Rica, Guatemala, all those guys, they're usually 5-10 years. They're going to make enough money to be able to pay off a house out there. They don't have utility bills. They don't have property taxes. So they can actually set their family up very well. They have no interest whatsoever in becoming Americans. They'll state it very, very plainly. They're here to get some quick money, not pay taxes, jump right back out, pay for everything in full, raise their family there, quite often have a second family here while they're here. And I've worked with these guys hand in hand for decades, so I know that system really well too.
So I think two responses to that. The first is, yes, there's absolutely, you're totally right. There are this group who has no intention of coming here and assimilating and becoming American. They're here to make the money and send it home and then go home. In which case, we need workers. We actually need construction workers. We need seasonal workers. We need farm workers. And if that's the way we're going to get them, great. So one of the things I dealt with in the Senate was businesses coming to our senator's office and saying, we cannot find seasonal workers. We have obeyed state law. We go out and we do job fairs. We are offering $25 an hour to basically do landscaping at this fancy hotel. We need workers. And if we can't get them from the United States, please let us bring in seasonal workers. This will completely change their family's trajectory, and we can stay afloat. Because if we don't get these workers, we can't stay afloat. Americans aren't willing to take this job. So I think that's the response to number one. And the response to number two is, man, the immigrants that I see in my classes, Venezuelan students, in the back row of one of my classes is an entire section of Venezuelan students. They are the most pro-American people in that classroom. It's the multi-generational white students who don't...
And there certainly are some.
Who don't give a
there's
darn...
There's exceptions to every rule.
...about American politics. But it's the immigrants who can turn and say, actually, you have no idea what you're talking about. You have no idea how good America is, how badly they want to be a part of it. And talk about the entrepreneurial spirit of immigrants. So the woman I'm naming my soon-to-be daughter after, her middle name after, is the daughter of immigrants from Mexico, and they are not here legally, and they have worked their fingers to the bone every day since they got here. They're deeply entrepreneurial. They are remarkable contributors to their community, and never once have they been on welfare. Not once. They haven't taken a single handout. That, in my mind, makes them more patriotic Americans than your average seventh generation American. So I don't think it's fair to just say...
I completely agree with that.
Yeah, to say immigrants...
I would agree with that as well.
They're not really...
The complication is our culture here can't continue to just accept that and become more and more complacent. We need to actually start forcing our citizens here to start re-uptaking these jobs and actually rebuilding our culture here instead of insisting upon importing a culture of other workers.
I like that you said forcing, okay? Because I don't believe in forcing really anything. Go back to liberty, right? I don't believe in forcing much. I would argue to your point about we need people to pick oranges and build houses and farm, right? Obviously, I think that goes without saying. And to your point too, I completely agree that there are generations of Americans who have grown up to be extremely entitled people who think that they are too good to do these jobs. And that goes without saying, okay? And that's a problem. And it's almost interesting because Rome's middle class was eradicated because Rome brought in so many slaves that the middle class stopped working, basically. And here we have an abdication of that responsibility, I think, in a lot of people, to your point about nobody wants to go and do these jobs that are Americans. And I think that that's a problem. And I think that's a problem that Americans have to recognize. I don't know that I have faith in these seventh generation Americans, to your point, to recognize that we need to do these things. Otherwise, you know, Americans have to have skilled labor, right? You know, there can't be a Knudsen like in World War II at FDR to look at him and say, go to all of these factories and we're going to ramp up the American industry and to keep up with the Germans. Like they're just, that doesn't exist anymore. Americans have to recognize that. So I think that your point there is extremely cogent. I just think that it's not just the problem of the immigrants who come here and don't want to assimilate, right? Because obviously there are both. That Americans have to buy into this idea as well. And that is, I think that that is more important than this problem that we're talking about over here, right? I also think that there's a conversation to be had about immigration reform and how people come into this country. I also think, TJ, you said force, that there should be some sort of civil service.
I wanted to clarify on that, just to make that clear. I'm not talking about force like under the rule of manipulating law or force by putting a gun to somebody's head. What I'm saying is we need to start making people have to suffer a little bit so they learn to get up off their butts.
If we and what I was going to say,
accommodate everybody's complacency and laziness, then all we're doing is making the problem worse. It's like constantly spoiling a child and never letting them suffer the consequences of their actions.
You're right.
So we
and
need
I
to
would...
suffer the consequences of Sorry. Our actions here and actually learn from our mistakes and become better people and realize that we have to be self-sustaining. We cannot rely on other cultures to come here and save us. We can't rely on goods from other countries to constantly save us. If we're dependent upon everybody else in the world, we are not a world power any longer.
For sure. You have a very long natural pause that throws me off, so I'm sorry for interrupting you almost every time.
No, you're good, brother.
I was just going to say, this is the only thing I would be interested in is doing what a lot of other countries do where there's mandatory service, right? But I don't think that there should be required military service because there's already a bunch of people who join the military voluntarily, get there and realize they don't want to be there. I don't want people in the military that were forced to be there and don't want to be there. That's infinitely worse in my opinion. I think that there should be some sort of civil service program that you can go into, or you have a window of time to go into. Before 25, you must do 3 years of whatever it is, whether it's military service or community service, however that looks, to essentially, A, you see how the sausage is made. You understand how contributing to your community is only going to make it better. This is an idea that we talk about here all the time. You're talking about shared struggle. When everybody is doing something and moving towards the same goal, we all have an advantage that comes out of that. And I think it would teach that lesson, so to speak. You know, so that is about the extent of force that I would go to have some sort of required service. And you can meet that goal by either military or civil service. And sorry, Dr. Johnson. You can go ahead. Looks like you're chomping at the bit over there.
Oh, no. We've spoken about this before, and I was agreeing that this would be such an interesting addition and a very positive contribution. Constitutionally, mm-hmm. It might be hard to do some kind of required service reform, maybe via amendment you could do this or something. But in the countries mm-hmm. where it's used, I think Israel, where it's the IDF, it has such a positive impact. Not mm-hmm. only teaching skills, but work ethic and binding people together. And I also think some of the natural ways to learn this outside of like more organized structures have just mm-hmm. kind of broken down. The family being one of the key ones, family mm-hmm. and community. And I think it hits young men in this country the worst. And as it turns out, duty and responsibilities actually makes you much happier. It makes you a capable citizen. And it makes you a man. That's what makes you a man. And it's sad to see an entire generation lose that. And I'm not sure, can you be a citizen and not understand duty and responsibility and adulthood?
No, I don't think so at all. We have a phrase, and it's even on one of our t-shirts. It says citizenship is not passive. And I think that a lot of these things we're talking about with immigration we have to abide by the law, like we've been talking about. Otherwise, citizenship means nothing. I don't think that there should be a lot of these programs we're experiencing this right now in California, where my son cannot go to public education, not that we necessarily would want him to, but can't go because there's a wait list because there are too many kids who are here and they are here illegally and they get first choice, right? And I don't think that is not okay at all in any way, shape, or form. Obviously, it's not those kids' faults, but I don't agree with that. And to not continue to have the same conversation, because we have talked about these themes heavily, especially on the last episode, I would be interested to kind of start talking again to your point about Congress. You know, what sorts of, you know, talking about what sort of forcing function in place do you think the Constitution is a sufficient forcing function for Congress to take up the mantle and perform its duties to check power in the executive? Do you think that the Constitution has the appropriate forcing functions in place, or would you remedy that somehow?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. I think the solar system created by the Constitution, the checks and balances, is remarkable. Mm-hmm. But it only works if you can connect ambition and self-interest to the place. Basically, if you can get members of Congress to think as members of Congress and not as individual political actors or as partisans. So it relies so much. Exactly. Or social media influencers. It relies so much on kind of the people and civic virtue. So here's an example of something I would like to see Congress take back. Tariffs. I would like to see Congress take back its tariff powers. This is the very first power given to Congress in Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution. Literally, their number one job is to control tariffs. Now, over time, they have delegated that authority to the president. For example, Section 301 of the Trade Act 1974 allows the president to set retaliatory tariffs. And then you have Section 202 of the Trade Expansion Act, which allows the president to set tariffs for national security reasons. National emergency kind of stuff. This is the fentanyl Canada stuff.
Right.
What the president's doing is not unconstitutional here because it's been delegated from Congress. But I don't think Congress should have ever delegated that authority. I want Congress to be a powerful competing branch of government again, which would require them to be functional. But I want them to take back the tariff power. There's lots of examples of this, of powers I want Congress to take back. But it all relies on Congress being able to think institutionally and not as partisans and not as individual political actors. And to Chris's point, not as YouTube stars.
No doubt.
I often say that the personal opinion that the founding fathers could not have conceived a time in the future where legislators would not want to legislate. It's something that they could not have imagined when they enshrined the Constitution. Would you agree with that, or what would your thoughts be on that?
I'm not sure. I do think they dramatically underestimated the vortex that would be the executive, the natural human tendency to want to give this over to a president. In fact, they were actually worried about legislative power initially. They were concerned that in a democracy, all power would be sucked like a vortex into the legislature. And so you actually had to beef up the president to make him capable of standing up to Congress, which is such a funny view 200 years on. But that was a very specific period. That's 1787 when they're thinking that. Prior to 1787, right, you have 11 years of deep suspicion of executive power. And so there's both in the founding. But yeah, they were more concerned about the damage Congresses can do because that was their experience in the states during those 11 years between the Declaration and the Constitution than they were about executive power.
So interesting. Yeah, because I mean, when you look at the system of checks and balances and the way that it all works, and I think it's such a glorious system because it also takes into account man's ambition and natural greed and wanting to attain power for themselves, that it's like, hey, we've got to set up this system so that as the executive is fighting and tries to enact or execute laws in a non-constitutional way, the Supreme Court steps in and says, this is my only client, the Constitution, you violated it, you're not allowed to do that. Meanwhile, Congress is trying to push laws into place, and then you have the veto powers. It's like, it's just so well thought through that you can see that they were planning for a governmental system where each branch was trying to fight to pull the powers apart. And then they were like, this is how we can make sure that government moves slowly enough to never allow for the tyranny of the minority. But then it's just so interesting to have watched specifically, this century, probably really in my recollection, and it's the period that I've studied the most, would be like World War II until now, of just watching Congress actually legislate its powers away from itself, it's crazy.
This is such a good point. Our history is one of swings of power between Congress and the president, right? You have periods of extreme presidential power always attached to a crisis, and then you swing back to Congress for 20 to 30 years, a bunch of no-name presidents. Then you get another crisis, and you get a very powerful president. We stop swinging. Not just World War II, you begin to see this with the theory of the modern presidency, even before that with TR and the rhetorical presidency, and the stewardship theory of the presidency. You begin to see this in the progressive era, this kind of presidential era. And then you really see it with the establishment of the administrative state post-FDR, that we just don't swing anymore because so much of the legislative function is done actually in the administrative state, and also because we're in a perpetual state of crisis on the foreign policy front. And so you're right, that swing just doesn't happen. It's gotten sticky, and who could have foreseen that?
No, I agree with that. I think it, in one of your episodes, I don't remember which one it was, you guys talked about them contriving the idea of veto power for the executive. And I don't remember who it was that you were referring to, so forgive me, and I'm sure you'll remember. They were talking about how strong to make the veto and that the president may be afraid to even use it. Could you flesh that out? Because I think it's relevant here in this conversation.
Yes, yeah. So just to give you an idea of how weak they thought the presidency would be, this is Madison. Madison was very worried that presidents who had an absolute veto wouldn't be willing to use it because it's too big of a power. And so that's why you have the qualified veto subject to two-thirds override, right? Because then if the people really want it, their representatives can do it anyways. And as it turns out, the veto has been remarkably powerful throughout our history, especially when they don't actually have to veto anything. It's just the threat of veto that's often enough to do it, that's often strong enough to do it. So they did have a blind spot on executive power. Hamilton didn't seem to quite as much, but certainly Madison did. A blind spot about just how powerful the American presidency could become, how naturally powerful it could become. And at least part of that story is political parties. I also didn't really see those coming in the way that they came. So is that enough about the veto? Should I have said more there?
Oh, no, I think it was you laid it out perfectly, because I do, like you said, it just talks about just sort of now in hindsight, just how sort of where they were right and where they were really right. You're right. And just sort of the way they were thinking about the way that governance would be here in modern America. I think that they would be really surprised to see a lot of things and the way it's played out, and maybe not.
Can I make one quick clarification?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, I'm worried I've misspoken. I don't mean to say that the founders created a weak presidency and would be surprised to see it powerful. They absolutely created a powerful presidency. Article 2 is a remarkably powerful president. I think they would have been surprised at how quickly Congress would abdicate its powers. I think they'd be surprised on which way the stealing of powers goes, not that the presidency is powerful.
Can I just like sort of throw more fuel on this fire of just like how genius I think that these guys were in a lot of ways? Okay, the Constitution is very short, and when you look at it, and I think that is intentionally done because it leaves a lot of room for interpretation, and knowing that you can't have a document such as the Constitution that isn't malleable, knowing again to their genius that this is going to be interpreted by generations of people differently, and that is sort of the beauty of this. And I think that is in a way the forcing function of gaining control back for Congress is an interpretation of what the Constitution means. And you mentioned before about delegating power, and I think it's a shame to see how those powers haven't been recalled. And I think that it's probably the biggest letdown to me to see how much this branch of our government is meant to be the biggest of the people portion. And it just absolutely mirrors the almost apathy most Americans have. And it's so disappointing.
That's really well put. Yeah.
Thank you.
I agree with that. One other thing to say about the Constitution and interpretation over time is the Constitution is short, you're right, and it has remarkable gray areas built into it, where the answer is, frankly, whose power is this? I don't know. The answer is, it's what the American
people
think.
Dude, where's my car?
Yeah, it's what the American people think at any time, that the ultimate interpreters of the U.S. Constitution is American public opinion, and I don't mean short-term public opinion. I mean the long-term, rational, calculated consensus of the American people, that ultimately they are the power brokers here. That's what they get to do. And you have an apathetic population. Well, then you have the power brokers who have not shown up for their job. And presidents can get very big. So these gray areas are essential to the checks and balances system working, but they rely on an American people who are deeply active and engaged in protecting the system.
No doubt.
That's exactly what John Adams was talking about when he said that the Constitution was designed for a moral and an upright people and is wholly inadequate to govern any other, right? Because it's a theme that we have here, that the Constitution doesn't protect your freedom so that you can do anything you want to do. It protects your freedom so that you can be free to do the things that you ought to do, right? Because, and this kind of goes back, I've been churning over and over in my mind your definition of what it is to be an American that you were saying earlier, and you said it was a common political ideal and a love of liberty, I think that you said, and the like. And I largely agree with you. I would also add to that our common heritage of Judeo-Christian principles on top of it, because all of our founding fathers, the way they thought and the way they wrote our founding documents were all designed, almost without exception. I know there was a few, Benjamin Franklin being the agnostic, but almost without exception was designed by their belief in God. Right. And it's like the idea of the three, you know, inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are afforded to you, right, by God, because by virtue of being a child of God. And these are the things that that the documents were designed to protect. Not that government can give you rights, because anything the government can give you, then the government can turn around and take away from you. But they were saying, no, these are rights that you have by virtue of being a child of God, and like, we need to protect them, recognize what they are, and then protect them.
Right. Although I think they were less ardent about the source of rights, right? It's nature and nature's God, right? They were equally happy to pull this from the Judeo-Christian tradition, as well as just from Enlightenment principles, which is actually just a secularized Christianity in so many ways. So definitely the Judeo-Christian tradition comes through, whether it comes through kind of the secular liberal tradition, which recognizes the individual, et cetera, or if it comes explicitly, it's certainly there. But they were less ardent on that point than we think, though they put in both nature or nature's God. Doesn't really matter. The point is, because you're human, you're born with these rights. And I'm not saying it doesn't matter. I'm saying they weren't making you pick. You have these rights because you're a human being, and government doesn't give them to you. Can't take it away.
Right.
Yeah. You got something, TJ? Morality and conviction. That's it. Just morality and conviction. Those are the two ingredients that are always missing. And conviction is a huge one, and it's something that everybody forgets about, and that's what we've lost again in society. And we've kind of beat that topic a little bit back and forth throughout a bunch of conversations tonight. But truly, it's one of the most important things, is people have lost their conviction. People do not want to put in the work. People do not want to understand the long game of it either. That, you know, we're not doing this just to see results for ourselves right now. We have to kind of let go of that selfishness, that greed, that narcissism, and realize that our forefathers, our founding fathers, the people who helped make this nation great, the people who industrialized it, they worked their fingers to the bone. They worked jobs that people didn't want to work because they knew it was going to make a better life for their families in the long run, whether it be their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren. They knew they were looking forward to the nation to come. It's just like people planting trees, you know. Same concept. The trees aren't going to bear fruit in your lifetime, but they will bear fruit for others. And that's that conviction. It's the willingness to do something outside of self.
Yeah,
and we've lost that. It's not a part of most people's morality any longer. And if we can regain that, and that virtue and those principles, which quite often are found, of course, as we were saying, through Judeo-Christian ideology, if we can bring that back, whether, you know, that moral compass is guided that way by God, and I always leave it wide open. Obviously, everybody knows where I'm at, but I leave that open to everybody else's interpretation as well. If you have that sense of morality and you have that sense of conviction, then we can move forward and we can repair. So.
And I agree that you have to have principled men and women. There's a Montesquieu quote that says, in Republican government, the power of education is required, or something like that. And I think that that's exactly what we're talking about. Education, meaning not just a traditional education, but an education on principle, right? And you can't have a government, you can't have a country without those things. Your quote, TJ, there, the post I made on Instagram the other day about planting trees whose shade you'll never feel. We need more of that in this country. And we've sort of beat this horse a little bit, so I'm going to shift to tariffs again, because there's a question I wanted to ask you. So you, when I had hit you about coming back on, obviously we talked about Trump's first 100 days, but the other thing that we talked about was tariffs, because you've been pretty proactive online about these tariffs. And one of the big arguments I see from people is like, oh, historically tariffs don't work. You can't point to an example in history where tariffs have worked. I think that's wholly false. I think you can point to instances where tariffs have worked. Obviously, no economic condition is ever the same, right? So whether you're talking about like the Marshall Plan or the tariffs that the United States enacted after the War of 1812, totally different environments. Therefore, you can't make there's not one single metric. I think the point is I'm trying to get at here. But why do you think you're so ardent against the use of tariffs? And do you have a historical reference point as to why you take that position? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So we've tried tariff regimes, 2 to 3 different times. First time is the 1830s. We see it again in the 1930s. And now we're trying it again. So I guess this is tariff time number three. The problem is each of these times was unsuccessful, and the third, I think, will be most unsuccessful of all because of how globalized the economy is. There's this great Milton Friedman quote he says, look at a pencil. There's no one country on earth that makes this pencil. That's how attached we are. That's how connected we are. And the second thing that deeply concerns me about tariffs is just how poorly it's been executed. So, for example, this just blew my mind. Currently, we have higher tariffs on intermediate goods than on finished products to the United States, and we're somehow still supporting the tariff regime. So here's what I mean by that. We now have higher tariffs on a battery coming from China to the United States, 145% tariff coming to the United States, than if that battery is sent to Vietnam, put into a Vietnamese-made laptop, and then shipped to the United States now at a 0% tariff. That is an insane policy. This doesn't push a manufacturing of the United States. It does the exact opposite. So if the claimed purpose for tariffs is to re-energize America's manufacturing base, then we are wildly incompetent in our tariff policies. Then whoever's in charge of this is failing miserably. So I'm both concerned about the execution of tariffs. I also am a free marketer and a free trader. And so I actually think even if other countries have tariffs on us, we still benefit ultimately in the long term from not having tariffs on other countries. There is a place for certain tariffs. I am open to that. But blanket tariffs on countries, especially on intermediate goods more than on final goods, is just silly.
So I actually think that that's pretty succinct, because we talked about this last night and sort of how China is pivoting toward ASEAN, if I'm saying that correct, ASEAN. And we talked a lot about, I made the point essentially that it won't have the effect that the Chinese are going to need it to have, because ASEAN makes mostly intermediate goods and that China needs finished product goods the same way that the United States does. On top of essentially the fact that our buying power and what that comes out to monetarily is like 3 times the size of the GDP of all of these countries that are in ASEAN combined, so that it won't have this goal, so to speak. But I guess my question to you is, and again, this is like a devil's advocate question here. First off, we should have never been in this position in the first place. I think that offshoring American labor was one of the biggest mistakes our government ever made. And people are right to be concerned about a lot of these things, medicines being one of them. We talked about that last night as well. But we should never be in the position to where we have to rely on somebody else for things, to the extent to where when it goes away, you're scrambling, what am I going to do? This is the same topic that people worry about all the time. If the power grid went down, do you have enough food in your house? All these things, right? You have to be able to be self-sustaining. And that just goes for individual and as a country.
I thought that was a natural pause.
It was. My bad. I'm wrapping it up here, and I'm going to put a bow on this question. Do you think that Trump is essentially just burning the boats and trying to make it to where there is no other choice but to sink or swim?
I don't know, and I don't think that would work anyways. But you make an interesting point about there's certain things we should never have been reliant on. So rare earth minerals, for example, the Japanese saw this one coming. They were much smarter than us and bought a bunch of land in Australia. Good for them. We didn't see this coming. And a lot of that comes down to really poor regulatory policy stateside. It shouldn't be so hard to get licenses to bypass regulations to mine here in the United States. We've done this to ourselves.
Oh yeah,
and I don't think the answer is I don't think tariffs are going to solve it for us. I think the answer is domestic policy needs to be fixed, regulatory policy here on manufacturing and on mining here in the United States. So I agree, we made huge problems, or we made huge mistakes that have caused problems for us. We should never be reliant on medicines, on rare earth minerals, et cetera, et cetera. But it's very hard to correct for now. So, for example, semiconductors, we are. Mm-hmm. We are late to that game. We're trying now. We've got a couple of facilities that are on track in Arizona, among other places. Mm-hmm. It's still so hard to set up manufacturing here. It will take 5 to 10 years to do it. When it does happen, it'll probably still be more expensive. We've done a lot of this to ourselves, and I don't think the answer is tariffs. No, the problem was 30 years ago. We can start solving this by correcting regulatory policy in the United States.
I completely agree. I think it's largely a crony capitalism problem over a foreign policy problem. Capitalism is great, but crony capitalism, you know, crushes the little man. Yeah, 100%.
For sure.
I mean, the point I was going to make, or the question I was going to ask you then, to go back to executive power, do you think that there is a place for eradicating the bureaucracy domestically, like you're talking about in these individual states, right, that have different, like California, let's just talk about a high speed rail in California, or the fact that it doesn't exist. Okay, we can't even build a railway here in this state, yet Gavin Newsom thinks he's doing a great job and started a podcast, but I digress, right? So with the Republican executive, right, do you think that they're is justification for being so forceful because that red tape in the individual states is so sticky that, to your point, 5-10 years from now is when we'll reap the fruit of doing these things, and he's trying to force this now because it has to be now. It can't be 10 years from now.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Federalism still exists, so states are still going to have different policies. It's going to be harder to build in California than it will in Texas. And so Texas will reap the benefits where California doesn't. So, you know, I do think federalism matters. I like the competition between the states. I don't actually want too much nationalization of policy in that regard in the hands of a president.
Agreed.
I'm also really suspicious of this idea that the way to destroy the administrative state is via the president. I don't actually think it works like that. I don't think the person most empowered by the administrative state can ever actually destroy the source of his own power. It's not how it works. Congress alone has to be the one to rein in the administrative state, not the president. Because again, this is where his power comes from, ultimately. Yeah. So I guess my answer is I like states to still have policy. I just wish I had better policies. And I'm suspicious of executive power, just period.
Yeah. That's a perfect, I've been dying to ask you this question all night, and that is a perfect pivot. So in speaking about executive power, and based on your expertise and wealth of knowledge in the presidency, in your estimation, which president has been most destructive to the United States?
Whoa. That's a really big question. I kind of wish I had all night to think about that, because I'm not sure the answer is so clear cut, right? I think the answer people would want me to give is FDR, and I'm not sure that's true. This is a man who led very capably in World War II, so I can't really throw him under the bus there. LBJ, maybe. I think his Great Society was a great failure. Frankly, I think President Trump has caused real problems for the checks and balances system. But we're only 100 days in, so who knows what happens. So I Woodrow Wilson. He's my least favorite president of all time.
Yes.
He's also, I think, the most racist president we ever had. There's just a list of reasons to dislike the guy. Also terribly sexist. There's just a good list of reasons to hate the guy. But I'm sorry. I'm not giving you a very good answer here because I need time. I need to like sit down the pros and cons list to give you the president.
Constitution season 3. All the presidents that suck.
All the presidents. Right? We actually do this in my classes. We have a greatest and near great and the failures. And I just let the students fill it in, right? It's not my job to tell them which of these is the right answer. But there's always like the big three, right? You can't touch. You can't touch Washington. No one is allowed to touch Lincoln in my class. He's off limits. FDR tends to be up there. And then the near greats and the failures, it's amazing. The same person, or you can have two people sitting next to each other and one person would put near great and the next person would take that same person and put them in the failures. So it's hard to know, but man, Woodrow Wilson, maybe. Wait a second. Woodrow Wilson invented the theory of the modern presidency, which involves an absolutely tragic misreading of the U.S. Constitution, Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution. I blame him for so much. My answer is Woodrow Wilson.
Thank you.
Chris seems to be happy with his answer.
I knew you'd walk in on it, ma'am.
Right.
That's always my short answer, too. There's so many reasons to hate Woodrow Wilson, and he vastly expanded the powers of the presidency, and then, like you said, invented the idea of the modern president, which is like this, you know, you're no longer executing laws given to you by Congress, but now he's setting the policy and dictating and kind of like this top-down rule and this nationalism. And like all of these things that like modern progressives the frameworks that they kind of work inside and the way that they imagine federal government, I think, is largely dictated because of Woodrow Wilson's viewpoints and the way that he, I'm not going to say ruled, the way that he served as president.
I think maybe we should also point out, though, that a really good example of the theory of the modern presidency is the first 100 days of Donald Trump. He is a modern president par excellence. I mean, think about it. There's four requirements for the modern presidency. This is actually a theory as an academic that Woodrow Wilson had. He never implemented it successfully himself because he wasn't nearly charismatic enough. He's a total failure as a politician. It's not till FDR that you get the actual like establishment, like someone actually is able to do it. Requirements of the modern presidency, the rhetorical skills. So the president uses his rhetorical skills to shape public opinion. The president is the center of policymaking in the country. The president is the best representative of the American people, not Congress, the president. He embodies their views, and the president uses his rhetoric to turn the people against Congress and to beat them down when they try and stand up to him. Basically, the centralization of power in the presidency, all linked to this almost mystical connection to the American people and rhetorical talent. Hello, Donald Trump.
I mean, it is absolutely true, and I like to say all the time, like all of the the Christian conservatives out there that think Donald Trump is the second coming of Jesus Christ. I'm always like, can we calm down on that just a little bit? Like, the man isn't a deity, but also I've always been of the side of the American president and the presidential election system that we have when it comes down to often the lesser of two evils, right? I look at his policies, I look at the things he's done, and I'm choosing net positives over, I mean, what was my choice last time? Kamala Harris? Let's just be honest, right? But he's certainly not Jesus Christ by any means. It's like, calm down, people.
Yeah, the hymns that people have made for Donald Trump, literally hymns, is insanity to me. If I went to church, and I don't go regularly, but if I did and that's what was going on, I definitely would walk out for sure. That's insane.
That would be weird.
Sure. It would be. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying that would be weird. Question. My congregation is blessedly apolitical. Yeah, I don't hear a thing about politics at church, and I like that.
I think that's the way it should be, quite honestly. You know, I'm here to hear about the word of God. That's it, you know, and fellowship with you people. And that would erode that fellowship, I think, pretty quick around the states. So my question to you is given the geopolitical environment that we have ourselves in right now, do you think that not having a strong executive would be just fine? Or do you think that the terms going or the metrics going on right now dictate we must have somebody who's iron-fisted in the executive.
Okay, so this is another really interesting question. There's two presidencies, or at least there's long been thought to be two presidencies, and one is the foreign policy presidency, where the president is the face and the primary mover, though does not have exclusive authority, and that's important. Always kind of hammered in. You could look at Woodrow Wilson as a great failure of this with the League of Nations, right? He's never fully in charge. I like that. And then you have the domestic presidency, which is kind of second fiddle to Congress. So when you say this iron will president, you can have that on the foreign policy side, so long as they're still subject to the Senate, as well as to appropriations from Congress for military spending, while not having the iron fist on the domestic side. So I don't think it has to be an either or. The president is supposed to be unilateral and powerful in certain regards, does not necessarily have to be in others.
No, I agree. I think two things can be true at once. And I think there's too much binary thinking right now anyway, from most people. I mean, this is this huge problem that I'm always thinking about, and I know you are too, in a lot of the content that you put out there. How do you embolden Congress to act? I don't have the answer. I don't know how to. I think, unfortunately, to use the word apathetic again, there's too much apathy. I think one of the best ways is to have civics in schools again. I think that there's far too little of that going on in the United States. There's so many people that don't understand, and I'm not buying, when I say there's so many people that don't understand our government, I'm not saying in any way, shape, or form that I'm an authority on it. But I think that I spend a lot of time, and probably more time than, and I think all of us do spend a lot of time and more time than most people do trying to learn about it. I just think that this goes back to the whole auditing thing, which you ought to be doing. And I mean, I think that's one of the best remedies to this is taking action and taking control of your life to understand and learn about the government, and then instituting these things back into education and teaching people about the government and why it's so important. And I think that that makes the establishment afraid, because people seem to have forgotten that this is meant to be a bottom-up government and not a top-down government, which is why I think you see the lack of that. But I think that's the best cure. I think it's just education in general, people growing up and understanding and learning why we have these things in place in the first place.
And, you know, I think there's a movement in this, a really positive movement in this direction. You have a bunch of civic centers popping up at universities across the country. And I'll just put a plug in for the one I'm connected to. I'm a fellow at the Center for Constitutional Studies at Utah Valley University, which is just fantastic. One of its primary objectives is to educate elementary and secondary school teachers in civics so that they can do a better job teaching in their own classrooms. And this is heavily supported by the Utah State Legislature, who say, actually, yeah, we need high school teachers, middle school teachers, and even, you know, fifth grade teachers who know how the U.S. Constitution works so that they can incorporate it into their own classrooms. So you have this amazing system created here at the Center for Constitutional Studies. They've got master's programs now for teachers if they want to continue that education. They've also done this. This is such a fun program. My friend started this up. She's a mom who's a fellow at the center, has just a child at home, and was like, how do we teach moms? So she started this program called Learners with Littles. And it's such a small thing, but anyone in Utah Valley who has young kids can come and listen to professors talk about the American constitutional system and learn a certain part
of
it while their kids are there. That's awesome.
That is awesome. I love that. I wish more states would be proactive like that and do things. I actually, now that you've said that, I'm going to Google, spend some time trying to find programs like that, because I think that's essential. You have to, I mean, there's so many people, so many adults out there who I know want to learn more, and they're like, where do I go to learn about this? And it's so hard to look online right now, because almost anything you look up that's political education has some sort of slant. It's just so hard to find, and I think that this constitution actually is a great place to go to keep plugging your podcast, because it is very objective. But it is, it sucks that we live in this world where there is just so much, you can't even go on. It's like going to encyclopedia. The encyclopedia isn't giving you slant, but the internet is, and it's meant to be a replacement. People would rather do that than go to the library where you can't find, I mean, you're going to find slant in a book, but you get what I'm trying to say, right? It's just, I wish to see more of that. I think that's the best remedy to all of this, is learning about it. And, you know, you have to take that into your own hands.
That, and I wish we could get politics back out of the classroom. Hmm. I wish we could get back to a place where teachers were able to teach a thing, and regardless of how I feel about it, I'm telling you objectively, like specifically history is one of the places that galls me the most, right? Mm. And you guys were talking about, you know, the political sciences, and it's kind of hard to talk about political science without coming from it, because you're going to have Woodrow Wilson has a view of the presidency that's this way, whereas, you know, John Adams had a vastly different view of what the presidency was supposed to be. So that subject's hard, but history in particular, I wish we could get back to a place of teaching it from an objective standpoint, where it doesn't matter how I felt about a thing that happened, this is just what happened, and then allow the student, you know, to work through it and come to their own moral decisions about what they're hearing and what they're looking at.
And you know what's
make a big difference.
You know what's awesome about that, Chris, is you could still provide political nuance by talking about the zeitgeist at the time. You want to talk about civil rights? You can still provide that nuance that teachers are trying to provide by giving their own personal opinions, by talking about the personal opinions of people who lived through it at the time. This is what the newspapers said. This is what this person from this movement talked about. You can still give that nuance. I think, and that's one of the beauties of what you're talking about, is there's history can provide nuance. It doesn't have to just be boring, cold, hard fact. We can talk about all of this and give, and you can learn about it from an opinionated sort of way by providing those insights. I think it's the brilliance of that.
I think it's almost more important, because what does it matter? It matters far less. I'm not gonna say it doesn't matter, but it matters far less how you feel about a thing that happened than it does how the people in the context of the time felt about it going through it. Mm-hmm. Because that's what shaped the decisions and shaped the actions and the outcomes that rippled through time that now you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And you have to be able to understand it from their perspective to understand why they did what they did. You can't just apply a moral rule from 2025 to 1865 and be like, hey, they're all
no
completely
doubt.
Wrong because of the way that society is now. That's asinine.
Yeah, you're not learning.
Yeah, exactly. But
yeah. I know that. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. And I know we're coming up on time. I had just one question for you left, but go ahead. It looked like you wanted to say something after Chris.
Oh no. I was just gonna say I had a professor in college who said I'm not gonna try and be objective here. I feel like I have spent so much of my life studying this thing that I actually just have better opinions than you. And he's a brilliant man.
Oh.
But I don't agree with his position on that anymore. And I think it requires something extra and difficult for a teacher to keep activism out of the classroom and to keep their personal views out of it. But I think it's worth it for the student. It's worth it for the development of critical thinking. And also it's the only way to get students to talk about anything anymore, because everyone's so afraid to give an opinion. So it requires stepping back and being quiet.
So I have one last question for you, and I'm actually going to throw some props to Gen Z a little bit, even though I talk so much crap about Gen Z. Gen Z voted predominantly for Donald Trump this election. So many of them did. And I think that Gen Z, for all their faults, every generation has its faults, right? But I think that they have a really healthy skepticism for everything they see and want to get to the root of it. And I think that that is something that a lot of that generation doesn't get the credit it deserves for. And I think that that's exactly sort of what we need, is people who are willing to question and go to, you know, source, right, online, asking source and finding the source material. I see that more from Gen Z, I feel like, than I did from my own friends, and especially my parents, who told me not to believe everything that I saw online and then now believe everything that they see online, ironically. So I just want to throw props to them for that, because I do think that they are more willing to do the work to learn something than most people. And if you guys have thoughts on that, you can chime in. But I think I know what you're going to say to this question. But what do you think about getting rid of the Department of Education?
Oh, so two things. One, I'm not sure the Department of Education provides any useful service at this point. My parents were both school administrators, and they spent their entire summers just filling out paperwork to comply with Department of Education requirements, which seems silly. So, you know, the majority of funding comes from states, from local property taxes. So little of it actually comes to the Department of Education. You can still do all the things the department does that are good, FAFSA, among other things, by moving them into other departments, the Department of Treasury. Sure. You can do civil rights stuff in the Department of Justice, the Justice Department. That would be fine. It's just kind of acting as a middleman. You could just goose block grants for education straight to the states. That would be fine. So I'm not devastated by the loss of the Department of Education. However, I do not think a president has the power to eradicate a department created by Congress. All executive departments created by Congress. So if Congress will pass a law eradicating the Department of Education, which is something we've done before, then I'm not going to weep about it.
Yeah, I kind of figured that would be your answer, because you are an educator. And a lot of the friends I have who are educators have the same opinion, that they think that the Department of Education is just a massive bureaucratic mess. So I'm glad to capture that, because I agree. And there's good and bad in everything. But like you said, those responsibilities can be shifted, just like the majority of the responsibilities that the CIA has can be shifted to other places, like the Defense Intelligence Agency, where a lot of those things belong. So that's a whole nother conversation that we've had on this podcast before. But yeah, I totally agree with you.
Ooh, that's a hot take, by the way. Interesting.
You would
probably laugh out loud. I had a conversation with a local elementary school teacher here as the wife of a coworker, and we were, you know, having some drinks around the campfire, and this was back during the middle of the Biden administration, and it just came up. We were talking about the Department of Ed, and I was like, oh, that's the most worthless department in the United States government. And she got super offended. Yeah. And I was like, well, I'll go one further. I hope that if we get a change in administration, we can completely downsize or even get rid of the Department of Ed. And she, you know, hit me with the, you want me to lose my job? And I spent the rest of the night trying to convince this elementary school teacher that she doesn't work for the federal government. She works for the state of Washington.
That's so bad.
It wouldn't go through, and she couldn't comprehend her.
You teach people?
I was like, nothing about your daily life or your job would change. Not one thing. In fact, you would probably might even get a raise, and like regulations might even lift a little. You might even be a little more free to teach if that was the case.
I'm curious if you wouldn't mind real fast. Why do you think what I said is such a hot take?
Oh, about the CIA. I am not an expert on intelligence policy or anything like that. So when I said it was a hot take, I meant it was something I'd never heard before. So
gotcha.
I don't have a formed opinion on that, because I don't know enough.
Okay, I thought you did have a formed opinion. I was totally interested in hearing it. I just think that a lot of the functions they do could exist in places like that, and that they have way too much independence, far more than they deserve. Is really just the root of that. Unless TJ or Chris, unless you guys have anything else for Dr. Johnson, we did sort of bust your heart out. So I appreciate you you hanging around and talking to us.
No, this was great. Every time I come on, I have such a good time.
I love that. That's what we want. It's
tons of fun.
It is tons of fun.
I'm very, very pleased to have been able to meet you, of course. I have not been on with you before. I am the producer, just in case you didn't know. My name is actually TJ, not what's on the screen.
Okay, I was wondering. Oh, gosh,
I forgot that was up there. That's terrible. Dude. I'm so sorry.
As soon as I popped on, I looked down on the mic for real.
Yeah, I didn't know what to call you.
Dang it. Not White Django. Oh man.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I was waiting to see
if you were going to say it. Luckily, you know, there wasn't a point where you were going to have to regard me directly, but I was wondering if you'd be like,
Dude, she just got a peek behind the curtain so hard, bro. She really did.
You know, I was sitting here wondering
this is how we prank each other.
How I was going to address you, and I was just going to say you. That's how I was going to deal with it.
You with the hat. Oh, never mind.
That's right.
Yeah. Mr. Vans, right. Hawaii over there.
It was lovely to meet you, though.
Yes, it was very nice meeting you as well. But yes, I am TJ.
Such a hard peek into Oz, co-host
of our live show. But yes, this popped up as a joke at one point in time because I'm always being given a hard time by all of our followers online about my voice. So this has turned into a thing.
You've got a great voice for podcasting.
That's what we say. You should. He's an opera singer, actually.
Are you really?
I have been, yeah, for a very long time. That's where I started off. I'm also a metal vocalist, which is kind of funny. So I've done the best of both worlds.
Wait, yeah. And are you also military? I feel like everyone on this is ex-military.
No. I actually worked as a liaison with law enforcement and with drug enforcement agencies to basically go and recover.
He's a bounty hunter.
Items that were being.
It really should just say Boba Fett up here. Yeah. I'm going to cut through your BS, TJ. TJ was a bounty hunter.
Fair enough.
An opera singer and a bounty hunter. You are a very interesting person.
Right? It's a little different than an officer
really
and a gentleman.
Interesting life.
It wasn't very good because they could hear him coming a mile away.
That's right. That voice, dude. That's how he lulled him into a false sense of security. He just broke out,
that's
you know?
Right.
Yeah, Pirates of Penzance. What's that? Oh, and then they just, you know, kicked the door down, you know? Well, no, seriously, thank you so much for coming on. I'll take the fact that you said you had a good time. That means that we could have a fourth one of these episodes. Yeah. And I enjoy having, and I know Chris and TJ do as well, having perspectives that aren't just echo chamber perspectives. And we love having these conversations because I think it's not only essential and necessary, but it's fun as well. And to hear and to learn from somebody who has not just the education, but the desire to have a conversation, because there's plenty of people who are educated and can't have a conversation. Those two things don't exactly always mirror one another. So again, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us. I know you're going to have your hands full here quite literally pretty soon. But maybe in a couple months or something, we can get you back on here and we can talk about the next 100 days. And we could do 100-day increments all the way through this, you know?
All right, I'm on board. I will do that in 100 days.
What number did you say this is for you? Just out of curiosity.
This is number 4 for me.
Ooh, I have 3,
congrats,
but
though,
I guess I'm in a unique position to where I always ask because I had to spend a lot of the time raising our children while my wife was having medical problems. So I was working and taking care of them and her kind of all in a sweep. So I've had the dual duty and I kind of always try to feel the pain of others in that. So you're moving to that same category with Chris down there, and 3 is tough. So 4.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, at
God
some point we'll survive.
That, oh, of course,
no
of
doubt.
Course. The Lord always provides, for sure.
Well, then I'll see you in 100 days.
Perfect. Well, everybody, thanks again for listening. Please check out the sponsors in the show notes. Head on over to redpillthreads.com/ICameWithFire. And of course, I'll plug it again since she did not. Go listen to This Constitution. You can find it everywhere. You can find podcasts. I'm pretty sure I listen to you guys on Apple Podcasts, so you can definitely find it there. But without further ado, thank you so much for talking to us, and I hope you guys have a good night.